You're listening to the Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Dr. Nina Show here on LA Talk Radio and Instagram. I'm your host, Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, and I am here to help you stop counting calories, carbs, and fat grams, or macros, or anything, or dieting, so that you can get to a healthy weight and also lose the obsession and the preoccupation with food, lose the shame, be free, be liberated. That is my goal for you. I am here to help you wake up and think about your day, not your diet. If you want to call in and talk with me today, the number is 323-203-0815. That's 323-203-0815. I have something to talk about, but I see Josh on Instagram has a question. He says, how does self-criticism lead to binging? Oh, well, that's an easy one, Josh, because when you're self-critical, you're mean to yourself. Self-criticism is not kind, as opposed to, you know, some self-reflection about how one might do something better or be better. That's different from self-criticism, which is mean, judgmental, often harsh. And when we are harsh to ourselves, we end up turning to food for escape. Because when we, if you're turning to food, you're turning away from something else. And often what you're turning away from is the awful feeling that you feel when you're being mean to yourself. You can't simultaneously be mean to yourself and supportive of yourself. That doesn't work. And so therefore, how being mean to yourself, having being critical to yourself, how that relates to binging is about escaping yourself. It's about comfort. It's about distraction. It's about going blank, going into like a zone where you're not thinking or feeling anything. It's self-abandonment in the disguise of some kind of comfort or distraction. So hopefully that answers your question about how self-criticism leads to binging, because it's so important to be there for yourself, to talk to yourself as if you were a friend. I mean, I talk about this in my book. You know, you got to turn your critic into a friend, because when you're critical, you just are mean to yourself. You beat yourself down. You feel bad. You would never say to a friend the things you say to yourself. If your friend made a mistake, would you say, oh my God, you made a mistake. You are so stupid. I can't believe you. You just suck. You're never going to do anything right. You're horrible. You're just like, if people knew who you really were, no one would like you, right? That's the kind of stuff we say to ourselves. And you would never say that to a friend. You'd say, okay, you made a mistake. You know what? Let's see what we can learn from it. It's not the end of the world, whatever. You'd say something kind and generous and supportive to your friends. Josh is saying, did we learn self-criticism from our parents? Sometimes, not always. Everybody's different and everybody learns to relate to themselves in a different way. Often it is from parents, caregivers, people who are close to us, grandparents, aunts, uncles, teachers, people that have a significant influence in our lives, coaches, people like that. There are two ways that we become self-critical. One is when we each internalize the voices that we hear. So if someone is telling you, oh, I can't believe you did that wrong, why can't you do anything right? Well, what happens? We start saying that to ourselves. Oh, I can't believe I did that. Why can't I do anything right? So we internalize the voices that we hear. That's why I call my work sort of a psychological exorcism. Here I am, a nice Jewish girl giving exorcisms. Yes, psychological exorcisms, because we got to get the voices that we hear that become our voices to ourselves out of our heads. So one way that we become self-critical is that we internalize the criticism that we are given. Another way is when things are too loose, right? Too, nothing's really going on. We don't have a lot of structure in our lives. We can kind of, there are kids who can sort of do whatever they want. No one is saying you can't stay up until 3 in the morning. You're only 13. Things like that, when there's no structure, kids create their own structure. And they create that structure by setting rules for themselves and being rather harsh. So Josh, I hope that that answers your question. How can we, Josh has many questions today. Love it, Josh. How can we learn to love ourselves more? Well, we learn to love ourselves not by repeating a bunch of affirmations. You can say to yourself that you are lovable and loved and you know, all the wonderful things. You can say it a million times. It's not going to change the way you feel. What changes is when we recognize where we got the idea that we're not lovable, where we got the idea that there's something wrong with us. Where did this come from? We challenge that, challenge those ideas. So, you know, again, if you have parents who are harsh, critical, judgmental, and I don't even mean abusive, you know, parents do the best they can given their situations, but sometimes their best isn't good for the kid. And that might not have anything to do with someone being abusive or bad or good or whatever. It can often have to do with a mismatch in the family. I've talked about my own experience where my parents are both college professors and very scholarly and academic and you know, my sort of quiet. I mean, unless my dad is talking to an audience, in which case he's a different person. I don't know, that person was not living in my home. So what I had were quiet, scholarly, academic parents, and I was not that quiet kid. And I was always being told, you're too loud, you're too dramatic, you're too emotional, you're too this, you're too that. And that that registered in my mind as I'm too much, which registered in my mind even more as I'm literally too much, right? Maybe if I shrank, if I got smaller, I'd be more lovable. And so that sometimes it's just a mismatch. And so it's so important to really look at how you got the idea that there was something wrong with you in the first place and challenge that and heal from that. And then you can you create a kindness towards yourself and an appreciation of yourself. Hello, I'm a LGBT person and can't find a true person. All people just hang out in my country. I'm a psychologist. I can't find a true person. Gosh, I'm so sorry. That sounds really painful. And my heart goes out to you. And I invite you to join my community where all are welcome, all humans, regardless of gender, sexual preference, identity, whatever. We're all are welcome because I'm interested in us creating a community of people who are supportive of each other for who they are, how they think, what they want, what they need, things like that. That's what's important, you know, not who you choose to love. Josh is saying your parents never told you that you weren't enough. Well, you know, not directly, but let's say you have a brother who's sort of a genius, maybe a little Asperger's now that I think about it, but sort of a genius who gets a full ride to, say, an Ivy League school, maybe Harvard, I'm just saying. And your parents are just really amazed that you got into a UC school. So did they say, oh, you're not enough? Not overtly. They did not say, oh, you are not good enough because you didn't get a full ride scholarship to Harvard. But they did say, wow, we're amazed that you got into a UC. What does that convey? Right? So sometimes it's very subtle. The messages are very subtle. They're not overt. And I'm not even going to pretend to, I'm not going to attempt to pronounce your name. I don't know what country you're from. You know who I'm talking to. I'm talking to you. Thank you. I'm glad that you're here. And please write me any comment in the Instagram thread or feel free to call me again, 323-203-0815. If you would like to join me or keep joining the conversation. Yes. Well, Josh is saying that's a very interesting childhood story. You know, not everything is overt. We get these messages, and often the messages that we get about ourselves are not overt. They're covert, or they're based on interpretations. Another person might have said, "Hey, you know what? You're so surprised I got into a UC. Whatever with you." For me, it was, "Oh, you don't think I'm good enough. You don't believe in me." So a lot of it has to do with how we interpret what goes along. What goes on outside of us, what goes on in our lives. Our interpretations are everything. Perception is reality, right? What we see, what we think, what we believe, how we interpret whatever is happening, that becomes our reality. And it can be very hard to challenge that reality. And you know what's really hard is when you intellectually know one thing, you intellectually know you're a good person, right? Josh, you know you're a good person. Everyone, you know that you are decent, good, a decent, good person, and yet you may not feel like it. Or you know whatever you know, but the feeling is in opposition to what you intellectually know. Josh, if you have parents that idolized you, that can also be hard because, you know, what's hard to be the black sheep, but it's also hard to be the golden child because the golden child gets put on a pedestal. Hey, no pressure. You've always got to live up to some idolized view of how you're supposed to be. And then that can be a way that you can create criticism too, when you fail to live up to the idea of who you think you're supposed to be. You have a borderline. So this is can you write your name in there so I can say it and without trying to butcher your Instagram name all the time? Says, I feel like stuck. My emotions are so powerful. Dad is borderline, not a good parent. Yes. So it sounds like, you know, a borderline parent is really a very, very difficult parent to have, because the people who are borderline, when you have a borderline parent, you're either elevated or devalued. You're either like the most amazing thing in the world, or you're terrible, or maybe you're only good or only bad. And they're unpredictable, and there could be borderline rage, and it's so chaotic and painful and difficult. Barack, am I saying it right? Barack. So Barack, I'm very sorry that you have that experience of a very difficult parent. And, you know, our parents are our first gods, really. We think our parents know everything when we're kids. They're gods. They know everything. So if they've decided that we're not good enough, we must not be good enough. Josh is saying that his father wanted him to be his personal success story. Yeah, so that's like being a reflecting him well, being a kind of a narcissistic extension of the father, which is horrible, because what those fathers can do is sometimes, or parents can flip. So you have to reflect them well, and they kind of take credit for what you do. But then if you reflect them too well, they get competitive. Right? They get competitive. So that is, it's very painful. to not be seen as a separate person, to not be understood, to have to perform instead of be, to have to think that you have to be a certain way or do certain things or live up to some expectation in order to be okay. How does this relate with food, by the way? It can leave a profound emptiness within. And that emptiness is often, you know, filled with food, which represents relationship. So what you can do, of course, is you have to do the hard thing, which is to mourn what happened and what didn't happen. If you have a borderline parent, a narcissistic parent, an absent, neglectful parent for whatever reason, a harsh, intrusive parent, whatever kind of experience you had, or if it wasn't your parent, it was your grandparents, or it was someone in your life that had a significant impact on you, what you have to do is heal by mourning not just what happened, but what didn't happen. And Josh, yes, you are welcome to call in to discuss this. So we don't do the Instagram, my reading your Instagram post. Absolutely. Barack, you too. Your pain is your power. Well, I would say that you have the power to transform the pain into self-acceptance and self-love and self-esteem. The pain is in what happened. The pain is the ideas you have about yourself as a result of what happened to you. That is the pain, but that pain can be healed. We have pain, we break an arm, right? It's very painful, but then we heal and then we have the use of our arm again. Same with emotional pain. It can heal. It doesn't have to affect us always. Yeah, it's... And how we heal is we mourn what happened and what didn't happen. And that's the part that gets left out. And it's so important. Oh, Josh, I think you're here. Hold that. Hold on. Let me just finish my thought. I think that's you, Josh. Hold on. If we don't heal the past, we repeat it in the present. We are drawn to people who are rejecting if we have a rejecting parent. We're drawn to people who are critical because we're trying to get a different experience with this new person that we never got with the original person. Edith, hold that thought. I'm going to talk to Josh and then I will be with you. Hey, Josh.
Hi, Dr. Nina.
Hey, Josh.
Thanks for taking my calls. What was that?
I said, hey, Josh, how are you?
Oh, good. So it's a very interesting conversation. It does have a lot to do with food, clearly, because food is sort of the easy fix. It's not drugs. It's not gambling. It's not, you know, it seems to be innocuous, and it can be sort of, we can hide our, you know, abuse, our self-abuse in something as innocuous as food.
Food is a comfort. It is distraction. It on a very primal level, it represents relationship. When we talk about comfort food, we really want to be comforted. We talk about being hungry for love, starving for attention. Our vernacular in our language really speaks to how food represents relationship and people. And if your relationships with people are complicated and difficult and painful, food becomes the substitute. And that's why we talk about comfort food. Even though on the surface, it seems to be just, oh, you know, it's mac and cheese or it reminds me of my childhood or whatever. But it's a way of comforting yourself when you don't have the words to do so. But it also evokes the sense that someone there is comforting you. We don't consciously think of it that way, but that's how it registers in our psyche.
Yeah, and I think for me, what's interesting is the, you know, the genetic link, if you want to call it genetic, which is sort of an antiquated term for this, but my father, if I was the narcissistic extension for my father, he also taught me how to cope because he modeled the sort of the late night snacking. So it sort of was all just there very easily for me to pick up on.
Yes, he modeled it, and therefore you saw him doing it. And even though he wasn't saying, "Son, I'm eating my emotions," you could pick up metacommunication, or however you want to put it. You could pick up that he was eating for a purpose other than because he was hungry, but there was something else going on. And you learned that. Plus, when we don't have comfort in words, we know that food can be a source of comfort. So that's why you want to look beyond what's happening with food and look to the why, not what you are eating, but why. What is going on with you? Is there an emptiness where people should be? Is there a lack of an ability to self-soothe because no one ever showed you that, did that for you, modeled that? What's going on?
So how would we fix if a child was the narcissistic extension? I mean, in your case, you weren't the narcissistic extension, but in a sense you were, because you weren't living up to their own narcissistic ideals for themselves. So how do you deal with being sort of connected in that way to a, you know, primary caregiver, a father or a mother?
Well, either way, whatever's going on, and it doesn't have to be having a personality disordered parent. It could just be a misfit in the family, or a depressed parent, or something else like that. You go through a grieving process, and that is, you know, basically Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's stages of grief. You've got to go, which is denial. That didn't affect me. It's all about food. You know, forget it. You're past that. Anger, bargaining. Oh, maybe if I just done that, they would be like this. Maybe if I just say this, they'll be like that. Maybe if I just X, they'll Y. That's bargaining. And then depression. Oh my gosh, this is who they are. It's never going to change. I need to accept it. And the next is acceptance. And by actually going through the experience, not just the intellectual experience of that, but the feeling of it. You can't think away your feelings. They're called feelings because you feel them in your body, right? We physically feel feelings. We don't think away feelings. It's the difference between saying, "Oh, I'm really sad," and crying, or, "Yeah, I'm very mad," and, "Oh, I'm so mad," right? One is you feel it, and one is you think it. By going through that process of what happened and what didn't happen, that's how we heal. We can be different to ourselves, and we can seek different types of people in our lives.
Yeah, like, you know, sort of like getting to the emotion, you know, because we want to take care of our parents. So if our parents need us to be a certain way, well, of course we're going to do that. And then the question becomes, when in adult life, did we feel about that? How did we really feel about what we had agreed to that we may have not have immediately agreed to with all of our rational thinking as a young child?
Josh, I want to challenge you. Are you up for a challenge?
Sure.
You're talking about the, like in general, we and us, and I want you to talk about me. This is what I felt. This is what I went through. Because when we talk globally, it's a way of keeping distance from feelings and experiences. But when we talk from an I place, it is more of an experience that's sort of, you know, embodied.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think for me, it's, you know, if I unconsciously was my father's sort of sense of his own success, you know, here's my son, is my firstborn son. Now all my problems are are over, so I'm going to place all my problems onto my son unconsciously and let him sort through them while I am, you know, championing my trophy son, who is not even old enough to know what his own body is or his own mind is or what the external world is, or even if he's separate from his external world, right? So I think there's emotions there from a very early age for me where it's like I didn't really appreciate being subjected to something that I sort of inherited, you know, just by being this man's child, this man's son.
And that means you're talking about hurt and resentment, and those are things that you've got to allow yourself to express, not towards your dad. That's usually not a great idea, but
right.
For yourself or with somebody else or with a therapist or with, you know, with a friend or, hey, with me, when you heal that original wound, you feel, you know, you stop seeking what you never got, and you feel enough. If you never felt like enough for your dad because you weren't living up to his idea of who you should be, that's coloring your relationship with yourself, I'm sure, and the world. But when you can challenge that, realize where it came from, then you can live your own life.
Yeah. And I think I could probably also recognize how I'm binging, how I'm eating excessively, if I am doing that, as a way that I've unconsciously chosen because it was available, because I had feelings that I couldn't regulate, and that has become a habit of regulation, of emotional regulation for myself.
It's a way of not feeling something. It's a way, if you are hurt, sad, mad, you name it, and food becomes the answer, then you never actually process the feelings or the thoughts. And then it becomes focused on, I can't believe I'm binging, instead of why you're binging.
Right. Yeah. That's amazing. I feel like it's real work that can be done. It's not magic. I mean, if you go in there and find out what those feelings actually are and spend some time feeling them with a therapist for an hour a week or twice a week or whatever it happens to be, or if you have a way to do it yourself, you know, in meditation or whatever it is that you choose to use to feel feelings. I'm talking about myself here, but I think then things can open up quite a bit, and they don't have to be so repetitive. You know, it's like a repetition compulsion also, you know, it's like a psychoanalytic term, but
Someone's been reading some Freud. Yes, the repetition compulsion is, if you have a, like, say, a critical father with high standards, then you can go out and you either become critical to yourself and have high standards, and also may, unbeknownst to yourself, seek other critical people, bosses, partners, friends with high standards that you can never please, and with the hope of having a different outcome. But when you're aware of that, once you become conscious that you're doing that and heal the original relationship, then you can have different relationship with yourself and other people. And of course, food, because when you can be kind to yourself and support yourself and comfort yourself and soothe yourself, you don't need food for that purpose or to escape.
Right. And so I could say to my dad instead, oh, Dad, you know, I hate you because you treated me this way. I could say instead, I love you for showing me how the human mind works. You know, I love you for showing me how complex, you know, without really doing real damage to me, because I was able to get help, you know, when I needed it, but just to show me how amazingly complex everything was when I had no idea it was this complex. And so I thank you for implicitly showing me what I would never have found out before. You know, it's sort of a very rich experience to be treated in an interesting way by parents, because it becomes such an amazing, I mean, look at you, now you're helping people with food problems. So in a sense, it could be reparative in a relationship by pointing out these things.
Absolutely. In fact, you know, I was talking to my parents a couple weeks ago, and my mom said something about how when I was little, like 2 or 3 or something, I don't remember this at all, that my dad had these food rules and wouldn't let me eat anything between meals. And I would go and steal stuff from the kitchen and go hide in the closet and eat it. So my mom said, so, you know, it's all his fault, all your food things. And I said, well, yeah, but I also have to thank him, because had I not gone through that, I wouldn't be here helping so many other people do it. So it was a blessing in disguise. And I think that's sort of what you're getting to, that we can find silver lining. Absolutely. And what's important is then you're not beating yourself up. You're not critical to yourself. You're not harsh to yourself. And you can truly live your life without your father's ideas about you haunting you.
Yeah. I think your mom, what an amazing thing that she did for you just recently. I mean,
when I was 2 or 3, I wanted to say, and you just let him, like, you know, so complicated. She just, I've made peace with my parents as fallible humans, as we all must do. And some,
but just imagine, Dr. Nina, just imagine what she, if this is how your father is, then I would just imagine how difficult it must have been for to be his wife, and to have to deal with God knows what other similar situations that were probably traumatic in the marital relationship.
Who knows? Who knows? I don't want to know. I got enough to deal with, but you're right. So, and then when you get that perspective, you're no longer in it. You're sort of an observer. That's why I say I'm a detective of the mind. We're going to be a detective going, huh, that's really interesting. That's a clue. And you get kind of an overview of it rather than being in it and repeating it and constantly feeling terrible in the world. And so for you to heal and to face and heal what your past was like will free you in the present.
Well, thank you so much. I just feel so blessed to be able to have sort of an ongoing conversation with you, someone who's as knowledgeable as you and who's so trained and experienced. I'm just very, very thankful. So thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Josh. Thank you, as always, for your calls. I really appreciate it. And I know because people write me and say how helpful they find your calls. So I want you to know that you're helping yourself, but also you're helping other people who are listening. And I hope that makes you happy. Makes me happy.
Well, it's really helping me first. So that's why I'm, you know, and I really do get help from it. Thank you.
You're welcome. And it's both are important. It's good to help yourself. As a side benefit, it helps others. Thank you, Josh. Call me next week.
Okay, will do. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. Two Instagram a comment and a question. Barack is saying that he was abused as a child and, you know, became suicidal and is on medical support. And I am so sorry that you went through that. That is horrific and painful. And often when we're treated badly by other people, we attack ourselves. Children, when they're treated badly, they think they're bad. They think, oh, this happened to me on some level. They think, oh, this happened to me because of me. What did I do to make this person treat me so badly? And then that's the beginning of shame, which is, oh, there's something wrong with me. And shame then can turn into so many different things. So it's so important to look back and heal the experience from a child, not from the child's perspective, but from your adult perspective, to see what happened, and from the eyes of helping a child that was you, rather than from the perspective of the shame you felt as a child. I hope that makes sense. And I'm glad that you're getting support, and that, and I just wish you all good things. You can recover from this kind of assault and abuse, and it's hard, but it is possible. And I'm wishing you all the best, and please, you're welcome here anytime. Also, Edith said, I met a guy and it didn't work. How do I get over him? Well, this is an interesting question, because who does the guy represent? Because if it's just a guy that you met and it didn't work out, you say, oh, sad, didn't work out, bummer. And you feel bad, and you know, you commiserate with your friends, and they all tell you you're better off without him, and blah, 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 blah. And then you go on and you meet another guy. However, if that guy on some level represents somebody else, then it's really devastating. And so to get over it, then you have to look at, well, who did this guy represent? So for example, I had a friend who was always dating aloof, critical, hot and cold, like real pursuer distancer type guys. And of course, this was just like, by the way, not her father, her mother. It's not always gender specific. So her mom was really hot and cold. Like sometimes she'd be all about her, and sometimes she'd be just like, don't leave me alone. Very hot and cold, aloof, and also critical when she was in that mode. And so my friend was effectively dating people who reminded her of her mother. And she was trying to resolve the relationship with her mother by dating one of these guys and hoping that one of these aloof, pursuer, distancer, hot and cold guys would just suddenly be very into her. And of course, it never worked, because those people are those people. They don't change. And this went on and on. And I told her, you've got to deal with your mom stuff. And when you deal with your mom stuff, believe me, things are going to change. And she said, that was ridiculous. She's like, I love you, but you're so wrong. Well, then she went to therapy, and she called me, and she's like, oh my God, my therapist and I discovered the most amazing thing. And I said, what? She said, these guys I'm dating, they're actually my mom. And I said nothing, but went, I'm so glad that you've come to that realization. But it's true. When she dealt with her mom stuff, guess what? She started dating nice guys instead of hoping to convert one of these aloof, hot, cold guys into a nice guy. So Edith, what you need to do is think about, is this guy a representation of someone who is familiar? Is this someone, does he remind you of someone? Does he remind you of someone? And are you trying to get something from this person that you would have gotten from that original person? It could be a father, it could be a brother, it could be a sister, it could be, you know, it could be a mother, it could be so many different people. But when we have unresolved relationships, we tend to repeat them. Josh was talking about repetition compulsion, which is that idea of what is not healed, what is not worked through and healed and processed and grieved gets repeated. You know? So that's why you see so many people who have alcoholic parents, and they say, I will never date an alcoholic when they're kids. I will never be with anyone who takes a drop of alcohol. And then what happens? They start dating alcoholics, hoping that this alcoholic will become sober when their parents did not, or their parent, or whoever. It's about toxic hope. It's hoping, oh, I can heal that past relationship by this in this present one that's so familiar. But all that happens is it gets repeated, you know? And then you also want to look at how the repetition shows up with your relationship with yourself. If someone is critical to you, then you're going to be critical to you. Back to Josh's question from the beginning of the show. How do we become self-critical? Well, a lot of times it's because people criticize us and then we become self-critical. And then if someone else is critical of us, we don't look at them and say, you are so critical. We say, oh, you are familiar. You know me well. Come here. Come closer. Let me try to make you into a nice person. Oh, and so on and so on. So when we heal that original relationship, when we heal the original wound, everything changes, including our relationship with ourselves. How does this show up with food? If people aren't safe, food, which represents relationship in our psyche and our unconscious, food becomes a substitute. You turn away from people and towards food. If you're empty and lonely and there are no people, or people are not making you happy and you're not having a fulfilling relationship, notice the language. Fulfilling. Oh, Barack, I'm glad that you like that. Yes, Edith, think about it. Think about how is that person familiar? When you don't have a fulfilling relationship, and again, I love language, it's so spot on, then you might fill yourself, fill the empty space with food. If you are starving for attention, starving for love, hungry for love, well, and there's not a person available, well, you may fill up inside. You may fill that empty space symbolically by eating. So these are all things, food for thought, if you will, for you to think about when it comes to your relationship with yourself, with other people, and with food. Because food is not the problem. It is the solution to the problem. The problem is self-criticism, self-judgment, loneliness, inability to self-soothe, no way to comfort yourself with language, no way to you know, feel safe in a relationship, things like that. Those are the problems. Eating is a solution to the problem. So, oh my gosh, we have 8 minutes left. Well, let me see. We need to get to the unconscious desire. Yes, Josh, we need to get to the unconscious desire, the unconscious conflict, the unconscious fear. We need to get to what is out of our awareness, but still in operation. Out of awareness, but not out of operation. I like to put it in different ways. One way, of course, is the weed and the root. What's when we see a weed, but if we pluck it, we know it's going to grow back. We can't see the root, but we know it's there. We can't see the root. It is in the dark. It is out of our sight, but it is still growing that weed. Same with unconscious ideas and conflicts and that, like that. We can't discern them, but we know they're there because there's the problem. There's the weed. Another way that I like to put it is, we can't fight an invisible army. We just get beaten up over and over and over again. But as soon as we make that army visible, when we make unconscious to conscious, then we can say, oh, I see you. And we can, I see you. You are not today, not today. And you can fight back. Barack is saying, it was my dad, sometimes close, but sometimes so far. Like I have to get that man. Yes. Okay. So look, sometimes that can then get sexualized, right? If you have, and I'm, by the way, I'm saying sometimes, I believe that most people who are, you know, gay or lesbian are born that way, but sometimes an unavailable parent of the same gender, that desire for that parent and that parent's love can get generalized to to sexual desire for other people of that same of the same gender. So again, I want to tread lightly on that, because of course I'm not saying that people are gay because of unresolved relationship with their same sex partner, a parent, but sometimes people do choose same sex partners because unbeknownst to them, they are trying to get the love of the original parent that was not available to them. For some people, just saying, something to think about. And Baraka, I'm so glad this resonates with you and that you like it. And please come back. I'm here every Wednesday at 11 a.m. Pacific, as you know. So I have about 5 minutes, maybe 4 minutes. I'm going to start talking about my topic, unless anyone has another question, in which case I will save my topic for next time. Questions? Anyone have a question? No. Okay. So we're coming out of the pandemic. We're starting to get together for dinner, for parties. If you're on Instagram, you saw that I did a 20s theme party for my friend, and we had the most amazing time outdoor, very safe. Everyone was vaccinated. Everyone dressed up like the 20s. And it was a blast. Great time. I don't think I've been to a party in, 2 years. So it was pretty awesome. The holidays are coming up. People are going to get together. So let me ask you, does that make you happy or anxious or both? A lot of events, because we're afraid of being judged. We're afraid of being, many people have said, I'm afraid I'm going to be the biggest person in the room. Carly Gash, thank you. Mwah, much love back to you. They feel self-conscious. They're afraid they're not going to fit in, literally and figuratively. And so I really wanted to talk about comparison to other people. Theodore Roosevelt said, comparison is the thief of joy. And oh my goodness, was he right? Comparison does rob you of your self-worth, your self-esteem, any good feelings you have about yourself, and it creates doubt. It's the worst. Comparing yourself to others makes you feel bad, which can lead to overeating or binging to feel better, right? If you feel bad about yourself and you do not yet have a way to make yourself feel better with words, you're going to turn to food for comfort. So what I am proposing is maybe the problem isn't your size. Maybe it is the size of your self-esteem, the size of your self-worth. And maybe that needs to be bigger. So what I want to do is help you. It's a good thing the show's over in 2 minutes, because I am losing my ability to form cogent sentences. I want to help you stop comparing yourself to others so you can feel good about yourself. That is my wish for you. And you know what? I think I'm going to leave this for next week, because there's a lot to it and I don't want to just stop randomly in the middle. So if you tune in next week, I'm going to be talking about this again. But there are many reasons why we turn to food. And remember, if you're turning to food, you're turning away from something else. It is resolving something for you. If you're lonely, it's filling the void. If you're sad, it's offering comfort. There's an ice cream called like bad breakup ice cream. It's literally called bad breakup, because the idea is if you're sad, you're going to eat a lot of ice cream to make you feel better. I think I even saw that on Friends or How I Met Your Mother. No, I think it was Friends. Thank you, Barack. See you next week. Who was it? One of the guys had a breakup and was just drowning his sorrows in ice cream. Right? We learned culturally, you're sad, eat ice cream. Well, we need to find a different way to deal with this. If you're anxious, eating will give you almost a sedative effect, especially if you have a lot of carbs, right? If you're all anxious and you're feeling, eating carbs makes your body go and calm down, and it helps relieve your anxiety temporarily. And if you're angry, crunching on something like chips or pretzels sort of expresses that anger. So be really curious about why you're eating instead of focusing on what you're eating or that you're eating. And that is the show for today. Thank you so much for joining me here on the Dr. Nina Show. I am here every Wednesday at 11 a.m. Pacific. And you can listen later on the Dr. Nina Show on LA Talk Radio, on Apple Podcasts, or anywhere that you get podcasts. If you would like to connect with me, please join my Food for Thought Facebook community, and sign up also that I talked about in the last couple minutes. That is Dr. Nina Inc., drninainc.com. Stay curious, not critical, be kind to yourselves. You deserve it. And I will see you next week, same time, same place. Bye for now.
You're listening to the Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle-Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.